This episode is made possible by Nielsen. Behind every good decision is great data, because when you're prepared, there are no surprises. Empower your decision-making with Nielsen's 2024 Upfronts, New Fronts Guide. Visit Nielsen.com for more information.
So we have to really start to think about, what does it mean to plan across everything? What does it mean to kind of like, how do you kind of create a plan that can flex and move? And how do you create a data ecosystem that allows you to give information so that you can make those decisions?
Hey gang, it's Thursday, March 21st. Allison, Ross and listeners, welcome to the Behind the Numbers Daily and eMarketer podcast made possible by Nielsen. I'm Marcus. Today I'm joined by two folks. Let's meet them. We start with our senior analyst covering everything digital advertising and media based in a region that city folk call upstate New York. But they'd be wrong, wouldn't they? It's Ross Benish.
Hey Marcus, yes, they would be wrong.
It's barely the Bronx, just above. We're also joined by the head of Nielsen Marketing. Oh, based, I don't know where, but she's going to tell us in a second. It's Allison Ginsheimer.
Hi, everyone. Yeah, I'm based just outside of San Francisco in Walnut Creek, so in the Bay Area.
Very nice. Welcome to you. Today, we're talking about the changing way we view TV, but we start, of course, with a speed intro to get to know our guests a little better. So, minute on the clock, let's do it. The first question we already kind of answered, but Allison, you are from where and based where?
I'm originally from Colorado.
Very nice.
Very nice, yes. And I am based in the Bay Area, just outside of San Francisco.
Okay. Ross?
From Nebraska, live in the Hudson Valley.
And Ross, what do you do in a sentence?
I work for eMarketer, Marcus.
Perfect. Same sentence as me. Allison?
I lead an amazing team of marketers at Nielsen, where every day we look to strive to deliver value to our customers and our prospects. And honestly, we're kids in a candy store because we work for the measurement company. So it's very, very cool.
Allison, what is your morning drink?
Hossie.
What? How'd you take it though?
Oh, black. Not now.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh, that's tough. Ross?
Orange juice.
Yes, better. Sunny D?
I prefer the actual juice now. But if I was going to go with the juice cocktail, I'd go Orange High C over Sunny D. Yeah.
Okay, fair. Ross, your favorite book of all time?
Flowers for Algernon.
Okay. Allison?
You may not have heard of it. It's called The Night Circus by Aaron Morgenson.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I bought that from my mum either Christmas ago or two. It's good?
Very, very good.
Very nice. And Allison, if you had to move, if you were forced out of the Bay Area, where would you go?
Probably to a remote mountain community somewhere in Colorado or California.
Okay. Good choices. Ross?
Japan would be awesome.
Yeah, it would. Yep. Very
Colorado
nice
is
folks.
Beautiful, though. Gosh, within the that's United true. States, I think that's like the most beautiful place in the country.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Well, there are two guests. Let's go to today's facts before we start the real show. Today's fact is, what is the largest private collection of books in the world? Any guesses, folks? How many books do you think one individual has accumulated?
2 million.
Good God. Ross?
Yeah, I was with you. I was going to say 1 to 2 million, but...
Well, you should, because you'd be spot on. How have you... I would have said, I don't know, like 7? Possibly. According to the Guinness Book of Records, the largest private book collection is owned by John Q. Benham of Avoca, Indiana, with 1.5 million books. There's so many, in fact, they're piled up in his two-story house, six-car garage, and also under tarpaulin outside.
Oh my goodness.
So he doesn't have like a private library for people, he just hoards 2 million books?
Yeah. If you wanted to find something, you'd never find anything. But where in the name of C.S. Lewis is The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe? You wouldn't have a clue.
Maybe he's got his own Dewey Decimal System there.
You know. It's true. Also, 1.5 million. Who the hell checked? The Guinness World Record person's like, how many do you have? And he's like, 1.5 million. He's like, are you sure? The guy's like, want to check? He's like, no. 1.5 million it is. I'll tell them. Anyway, today's real topic. What even is TV anymore? So in the lead, we're talking about what TV is anymore, what it's become. But we'll start with what does watching TV mean anymore? I feel like it means a slightly different thing to a lot of people, but most folks would still be in the same vicinity, I would imagine. Allison, what does it mean to you?
I think you kind of led into it. It depends on who you're talking to. Mm. And really it means, I mean, the audience, like our chief product officer says, no one wakes up and goes, I'm going to watch some streaming today. It's just not like kind of how we think about it as consumers. We think about shows, we think about where we might watch it, but we don't kind of think about it. And, oh, I'm going to go watch me as some linear television. Yeah. It's not just
it's like shopping, right? Yeah. I'm not going to go. I'm going to go do some in-store shopping.
Yeah, exactly. I'm going to go to a shopper, Sunday shopper experience. Like that's yeah. No. But I think in the industry, advertising agencies, publishers, we have to find categories for it in order for us to understand where viewers mm-hmm. are really bouncing back and forth and really speak about the dynamics. But my son honestly thinks, you know, YouTube is TV if I asked him what it was, you know? So mm-hmm. I think you get some people that argue, and maybe you guys do too, that the type of content or the type of device or the demand, is it programmed? Is it live? Like really defines television. But I think it's what is consistent across all of that is that how we've defined TV is changing and yeah. TV is truly converging. And if you think about the flexibility of viewing television, it's amazing how we can view television no matter how you define it today.
Yeah. Ross, I mean, you put together, to me, just a fantastic explainer in terms of how to navigate, you say, the complex TV streaming landscape. And there are these different buckets, and we do that so we can make sense of this world. But if someone said, what does watching TV mean anymore, what would you say?
Well, Allison makes a good point that in the advertising trade, it means something different than it does to ordinary consumers. Like we have all these terms like linear TV and OTT and so on, because that affects how the advertising is bought and distributed. So TV can mean, you know, linear or it can mean streaming. It's just completely different. But to a consumer, yeah, no consumer saying I'm going to watch OTT or I'm going to fire up my linear TV and watch a cable network. Like no one says that to them. I think it's just they're watching video that's primarily shown on a big screen. And it doesn't have to even be on a big screen. They may watch it on their phone or their laptop. But, you know, video that's like at least a minute long. You know, when you get into the really, really short stuff, I don't think that's quite TV yet. That's more like social. Like if I'm watching a 30-second thing on Facebook on my phone, I don't think most people would count that as TV. But a 5-minute video on YouTube on my phone, a lot of people would.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. The duration also comes into play. Regardless, American adults, we have watching 6 hours, 45 minutes of TV and video combined per day. It's according to our forecasting team. That TV and digital video time is via any device, including time with videos on social networks. So 6 hours, 45 minutes. And that number is still growing somehow. We expect folks to add another.
That's concurrent too. So
right.
Like you can be counted twice. Like we'll often watch something on TV, like my wife's watching some show that I don't want to watch. So I'm watching YouTube on my phone, but I'm watching the phone and the TV. That's
yes.
That could be 2 hours happening within 1 hour.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So if you're watching a smartphone, that would be 1 hour. Whilst watching the TV, that's another hour.
It just makes the 6.5 hours seem less apocalyptic.
Yeah, that's true. It is still growing though.
Oh, it's
5 minutes
a lot of time
per day.
For sure.
It's going to grow. Next year is getting very close to the 7-hour day mark, but you're right. Yeah, it is concurrent. So Allison, how does this redefining of TV reshape marketers' approach to the entire campaign life cycle?
I mean, it challenges it, right? It upends what we traditionally have thought about, but it also creates so many cool new opportunities. You know, when we started in traditional planning, you kind of had this set it and forget it planning, or maybe even annual planning. With all the new ways you consume TV, the non-program nature of it, the bigness of live moments, they're all creating these new opportunities for advertisers and for marketers to really take advantage of moments throughout the planning cycle, throughout the year, throughout the day, in ways that we never thought about before. Mm-hmm. I think the other really cool thing is just advanced audience planning. You know, TV was kind of, you know, an agent demo world. And now you can really start to really target TV, think about TV in more types of parameters around what the audience looks like than we ever have before. Mm-hmm. And that's all because we've got all these really cool new data sources that come into play when you really can bring TV. And someone like me who grew up in digital, you know, I'm kind of like, there's a freedom to this new television that's like, oh, it's closer to what I know. Mm-hmm. Like I start to understand it better, and it just changes how we think about planning, which I think is really cool.
Yeah.
And creates all these new ways to do stuff with such a broad market than we ever have.
Yeah. Yeah. I really like your gauge because it brings everything in one place. And I use it all the time. And it's a lot of the time you used to have streaming over here and what are those players doing in cable or, you know, TV broadcast over here and what are those players doing, and having it all in one place and seeing, you know, what share of Netflix is streaming, but what share of Netflix is of the whole TV world is incredibly helpful to have everything in one place. Ross, what do you make of how...
Well, I was just going to say that the gauge is also cited by so many of those companies. Like if you read Netflix or any, or any of those companies, they seem to love it too. I think it's nice that it's also updated fairly often. Is it monthly?
Yes.
Updated monthly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Incredibly helpful. So with how fast things are moving, Allison, can you actually plan for anything anymore?
Yeah, I've heard some say recently that, and maybe you guys have an opinion on this, that planning is a dying art form, or it's an art form of the past. And, you know, really, we have to kind of move into this always on approach, which I think we're getting to. But, you know, that's hard for people who we've all been planners. We were all taught to be planners. Mm-hmm. But marketers, we're chasing the data now, right? It's in silos. It's held up in different places. I was talking to a friend of mine and he was like, I don't know how to plan for this year. I've got to do like five plans, you know, to even get to one plan. How am I even going to do that? But if we do that, then we were just talking about how audiences are jumping over. I think, Rush, you were saying, like, I'm watching a YouTube video. My wife is watching something on, you know, television. If we plan, our experience is going to show up in the same silos that we plan in. So we have to really start to think about, what does it mean to plan across everything? What does it mean to kind of like, how do you kind of create a plan that can flex and move? And how do you create a data ecosystem that allows you to give information so that you can make those decisions as new channels come on board, right? As the dynamics of new TV, you know, ecosystems come on board, as new shows get released on Netflix and all of a sudden everyone's watching Suits, you know, how do you even plan for that? If you do an annual plan, you can't do that. But it doesn't mean you don't plan at all. It just means you need different data sources and different ways of planning.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's just when Netflix, you know, they did that big data drop to show like the number of hours viewed on all their shows. But, you know, if that happens like biannually, you're talking about marketers planning, like that could be too late because like that show has already gotten all its viewership or 90% of its viewership that's going to get if it's a brand new show. And they're wondering like, well, what's going to happen? What's the viewership going to be like in May? I don't know how you do predictive when you kind of have that lag. And the other streaming services don't even do what Netflix does. So I think you're flying a little more blind.
No, which makes the data that you have available to you to plan and measure really, really, really important.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, I was just thinking about, we talked about Ross, you're saying every 6 months, the gauge being updated every month. And it does seem as though getting as close to real-time data as possible is the goal here, so that you do have fresh numbers, so you are planning for the moment and not for something that, you know, may have changed in the last 4 or 5 months. You just don't have the fresh data to support which decision you're going to make. And so, Allison, you've noted that not all data is created equal. So in your opinion, which data kind of rises above the rest?
I think it's got to be data you can trust. You know, we have a lot of interesting conversations around the office around like how personal a decision that a marketer makes really is. You're standing in front of your CMO, your CMO is standing in front of your CEO, your agency is standing in front of their client, recommending how to spend, in some cases, billions of dollars. You know, so you don't want to, you know, you mentioned the speed of data. I worked with a great head of measurement once. He said, I make really serious decisions not on fast data. I'll make optimization or small decisions on data I get really quickly. But when I want to make a serious decision, I want to know the data science behind it. I want to know that it's grounded because my name is going on that when I say that. And so I always think about that when like, what data do you make those decisions on? And, you know, you got to be able to trust it. And to trust it, it's got to be stable. You know, it's got to be cross-channel. We just talked about those viewing experiences. You can't just live in a silo. Consumers don't live in a silo. Media plans don't live in a silo. Great campaigns don't live in a silo. You know, I looked at even the Dunkin' Donuts campaign. I don't know if you guys, I've really loved that campaign. I lived in Boston for a long time. So that really, but if you watch, that campaign was so much more than just the Super Bowl commercial. It was a whole series of behind the scenes content that they released in all kinds of places. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you measure that? How do you plan for that if you only plan the Super Bowl buy? You know, so you really have to be able to look cross-channel, which means you have to be platform and publisher agnostic. You can't try to piece all those data pieces together. You know, one thing that we at Nielsen really care about is that it's representative of the audience and that it's deduplicated. you know, am I serving one frequency, you know, 100 frequency to one person or one frequency to 100 people? You know, what's happening? And you, of course, in this data, how we all got into some of these situations is that you have to check those regulatory and privacy safety boxes. Like, those matter. We as marketers have learned, like, we've got to really make sure that our data is privacy safe. We're passing all the regulatory parts of that. And it's got to be independent. It's got to be in a way that the advertiser and the agency and the team can really say that this is an unbiased view of what is happening. Mm-hmm.
Ross, what does good data mean to you?
Well, it's something that I can chart and put in a report.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, a lot of the things you were saying is kind of what our company, What eMarketer, kind of also strives for: trust, vetting the data, high quality, not rushing through things. And I think that will always continue to matter.
Should make sense with reality too. I mean, sometimes you'll see some external ad spending estimates and like, you'll see like the open market is like way higher than like every other research firm in the world predicts. And so like, you know, you don't want to cite that. So there's some ways to, you know, almost like a meta analysis to make sure that what you're getting is valid.
Yeah. Like the eye test, they call it in sports, right? You can see all the analytics you want, but there's the eye test, which tells you, can also tell you what's going on.
I think, Rush, you said something that's interesting though. We were just having a conversation about this, which makes it so timely, is that the data does have to be something you can understand. You know, like good data is data I can put in a chart and understand and analyze. You know, that's true. It can't be so complex and, you know, confusing that you can't do anything with it.
Yeah. Yeah. Financial derivatives aren't going to help marketers plan right now.
No.
Or something like an econometrics journal. Like, yeah, you try to not be too arcane.
Exactly.
Well, that is all we have time for the lead. We will leave the conversation about how watching TV is changing there for the moment and move to the fourth quarter of the show today in other news. Live TV is the new streaming, apparently, and Walmart announcing that it's buying TV maker Vizio. Story one, live TV is the new streaming, suggests Angela Watercutter of Wired. She writes that Jon Stewart is back in Super Bowl 2024. Had 123 million US viewers. Live TV is making a comeback and it has streaming to thank. Ms. Cutter notes that with streamers raising prices and adding commercials, maybe the urgency of watching something as it's happening has the juice to bring people back to broadcast. And in a quest to get more subscribers, one of their biggest plays has been to secure the rights to live sports. But Allison, what is your take on this piece?
It's so cool. You know, I think I hadn't realized live streaming had gone anywhere until, you know, as I looked through the eyes of my son and we're watching the Super Bowl and he goes, I'm like, this is happening right now. And he's like, really? Like, it was surprising to him that it was a live show, you know, and I was like, wow, you know, he's not experiencing that many live TV moments. Mm. But I think what's so cool about these new live TV moments is it really is the definition of convergent TV. It's showing up. You can watch it in so many different ways live. And I thought that was what was really amazing about, you know, the Super Bowl and some of the other, you know, sports that came out, other games that came out during that period of time, is that you could watch it in so many different places. When it used to just be that one place at that one time. And so we talk about streaming really helping to boost viewership. It just created so many avenues to reach a broader audience, which I think is an advertiser's dream. Those live moments really gather people in one place. And so that ability to really reach them across everyone and to watch Jon Stewart on The Daily Show again. I mean, come on. Like, that's been awesome.
Ross, any thoughts here?
I have watched a few of the Jon Stewart episodes and they were better than I expected them to. A lot better than his Apple show was. So Allison mentioned convergent TV. The long time linear had become more like streaming ever since the introduction of TV Everywhere and vMVPDs. And now you have streaming becoming more like linear with so many of these SVOD services having live programming that comes from their affiliated broadcasts, like watching live NBC or CBS content on Peacock and Paramount Plus.
Mm-hmm. Story two. In February, Walmart announced that it was buying TV maker Vizio for over $2 billion. And Amy Pitchy of CBS News explains why, noting Vizio, mainly known for its TVs, also operates the SmartCast operating system included in every Vizio TV with over 18 million active accounts. This helps Walmart reach more folks with ads and develop its own entertainment content, something it might link to its Walmart Plus membership, suggests Neil Saunders, Managing Director of Global Data. But Allison, what was your take on this deal between Walmart and Vizio?
There's so much in this trend. There's so much going on in what you just said. There's the retail media network trend that we're really enjoying, where we're able to leverage, you know, first-party data from retail media companies in order to target in a cookie-less environment that we're all growing to. And then there's the growth of CTV. There's the growth of this new channel. And this, you know, the Walmart Vizio acquisition is just a perfect part of that, two parts coming together in that trend and proving, you know, that first party data really is key. We knew it was going to be, we kind of had all predicted it was going to be a big part of the story, but it's really kind of new onboarders, clean rooms, ID solutions. All of that took what we knew was really powerful and has made it a really big part of the future state of the media industry. So I'm excited to see what Walmart and Vizio are going to do together.
Mm-hmm. Ross?
The ACR data component seems more important to Walmart than the ad revenue alone that they will generate from Vizio. So, you know, all that viewing that's happening on Vizio smart TVs is generating a lot of valuable data for marketers and retailers. And now Walmart has access to that data, and they could probably leverage that across their portfolio. Mm-hmm.
And that is all we have time for today. Thank you so, so much to my guests. Thank you first to Allison.
Thanks, guys. That was a great time. Thank you.
Thank you to Ross.
Thanks, Marcus.
Yes, indeed. Thank you to Victoria, who edits the show, James Stewart and Sophie, the rest of the podcast crew. Thanks to everyone for listening in. We hope to see you tomorrow for the Behind the Numbers Weekly Listen, an eMarketer video podcast made possible by Nielsen.